This is Tim Cox, director of Miss Nobody, and you're listening to the Get Your Film Fix podcast.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer, and I'm joined by Lee Carlo and Jeremy Fisk. Today, we're going to be talking about the new Robert Redford historical courtroom drama, The Conspirator, which came out, coincidentally, on the anniversary of Mr. Abraham Lincoln's death, April 15th. After that, we're going to have a discussion on courtroom dramas. And then we're also going to have another discussion on actors turned directors. And then we're going to wrap everything up with our top five lawyers in film history.
Lincoln's been shot.
One bullet may have killed our beloved president. But not one man!
You are charged with having received, entertained, harbored, aided, and assisted John Wilkes Booth, John A. Surratt, and their confederates in traitorous and murderous conspiracy to kill Abraham Lincoln, Vice President Andrew Johnson, and Secretary of State William Seward. How do you plead?
I am innocent.
So we checked out the new film, The Conspirator, directed by Robert Redford. It kind of occurred to me that, like, whenever you're making a political, historical film of some sort, you're almost always bound by two things. It's historical accuracy and sort of what current political parallels you can draw. With Redford's The Conspirator, it's a courtroom drama surrounding the alleged involvement of Mary Surratt with the conspirators who, with John Wilkes Booth, killed Abraham Lincoln. It's clear Redford went to painstaking lengths to assure accuracy of the story. And if you want, you can, of course, read into an array of, like, post-9/11 constitutional injustices from Guantanamo Bay to the Patriot Act. So my question to you guys is, was the combination of the history and the political parallels enough? And was it thought-provoking material to get you through this two-hour-plus movie, or were you like me and thought, with all the concentration on the history, he forgot to make an engaging story? And Brantley, I'll throw it to you, actually, first.
Yeah, I mean, I'd tend to agree that he didn't really make as engaging of a story as he could have. I think he kind of got bogged down in that historical aspect of the film, and it just it felt like you were in school, you know, like you were in school, you know, having to learn about it rather than enjoying a film, you know what I mean? So that was the biggest problem I had. And honestly, I don't even think he went very political with it. I mean, I think, like you said, you can definitely infer things, especially, you know, in the post-9/11 world we live in with the Patriot Act. But I think he didn't really even make it engaging on that front at all, because I think he just focused too much on the historical aspect of it. So I would completely agree with that point.
Well, I fault Redford a great deal for this movie, mostly for the way it was made. But it begins with the script. This was a terrible script that somehow found its way in the hands of Redford, who then kind of put together an eclectic and halfway decent cast, but then completely half-assed his way through directing this. And it ended up looking like a, you know, History Channel reenactment.
Well, what I thought, and it kind of right in the middle of you two, is this is how I felt like this movie was. I felt like it came off like a middle school play where it was more important for the kids to learn the history than to actually make an engaging story for their audience. Like the teacher put on the play so that it would be something that they learned from, and they have to, and the dialogue would be very on the nose, and they'd have to say exactly what had happened at those moments. But it was the play wouldn't have been about telling a story, telling an engaging story.
Well, that's what it makes me seem like. I mean, everything about this screamed made-for-TV movie for me, because you have this, like, historically accurate script, which I feel like the writer, James Solomon, wrote historically accurately, but maybe never took the fundamentals of storytelling into play to make something engaging and compelling. And then, you know, some of the time that's overlooked because you get people like James McAvoy knocking it out of the park. But then you get Justin Long the rest of the time talking.
I don't know if James McAvoy knocked it out of the park, though.
I think he was great.
I think he was a good actor, but I don't know. I like him. I thought he was good. But he also kind of pulled me out of the movie. He had this modern sort of northern quality to
him. His American accent, maybe.
But it's true. Like, I felt like he was pulled out of today's world and thrown into that. Which was interesting because he's done so many period pieces that have never taken me out of the movie.
See,
like
I never
that.
Felt that way about him. I felt that way about a lot of other people.
Justin Long from the get-go. What are you doing in this movie?
Alexis Bledel was the same way.
Horrific.
Evan Rachel Wood was terrible in this. The only two people that – well, Kevin Kline and Tom Wilkinson just looked like they kind of cashed it in for this one.
Kevin
Kline looked like he was having fun getting to play
the
villain type role a little
but
bit.
But the villain was so one-dimensional.
Yeah, exactly.
So one-dimensional.
But for those two who I don't think I'll ever fault for turning in a bad performance, I will call what they did more just either having fun with just a movie that you wouldn't call – it's not like we're watching Red here. You know, it looks like they're just doing whatever. They don't really care about this movie. And then Robin Wright, I thought, was fine.
But she played her character – like, she was fine, but she played her character like a martyr. Like, the whole thing
was
just
–
I understand. But she nailed – like, with everything else in this movie, on the nose. This is what you have to feel about this. Let's compare the dialogue to the set design in this movie real quick, because I think it's interesting. Because they treated the dialogue – like set design. The set design was very accurate. It was very pretty. It was aesthetically interesting. The dialogue but like the set design basically served the history. The dialogue was the same way. It was exactly there to serve the history and tell the audience the story. It was so on the nose and it was so cheesy.
The funny thing about you saying like the dialogue is there to serve the history, and this goes a little bit to you're talking about taking James McAvoy out of today and throwing him into this time period, is that sometimes, and even in the midst of a conversation, one person would be speaking the way they spoke during that time period, and then the next person would come back and just talk like we're talking right now. And the scene that I remember specifically is one of the many scenes when Mary Surratt is in the prison cell and James McAvoy is there talking to her about, you know, what she's dealing with and why she has to tell him where her son is and everything. And she's just like, you think that I would turn against thy son that I birthed, or some, you know, crap like that. And
almost
then James McAvoy's like, yeah, if you did that, you'd live. I'm like, well, what period are we in here? And it's like the dialogue is serving the time period, except sometimes when they didn't know how to write that.
Even say the dialogue is serving the time period. That's not what I meant. The dialogue is serving the history, to say the history, and to tell the audience what was going on. I remember specifically a scene towards the beginning where Wilkinson's character was going to be defending Mary Surratt, and James McAvoy comes up to him, and McAvoy has to tell Wilkinson everything that Wilkinson should already know about why it was a bad idea to do this case and this and that, and like literally saying to Wilkinson the bare minimum of what this case entails, something that him as her lawyer would obviously already know. So the scene solely served the purpose of telling the audience. Mm-hmm. And not, I mean, you need scenes like that. And last night I watched JFK to sort of compare the two movies, and JFK is almost all exposition, but it's totally fascinating exposition, and the dialogue's written very metaphorically, and the characters were super interesting, and this movie didn't have any of that sort of engaging mystery that would pull an audience into it.
Well, it goes to, and I wanted to bring up the opening couple scenes of this movie, because you first have this opening scene with McAvoy and Justin Long that was there, I guess, to show that they're friends.
That they were in the war, that
yeah,
they served.
Yeah. But, you know, not necessary.
Can we wait real quick, but before you go, why did he start telling that story at the beginning and then never finish it?
Yeah.
I thought at least maybe at the end of the movie they would...
Oh, in my notes I wrote, what was the point of that story? Yeah. Like, figuring that I would ignore that and come back to it and be like, that was the point of that story, but
right.
Never did.
Never.
But then after that, you have, of course, the, to use the word reenactment again, of the assassination of Lincoln. And talk about a lack of suspense during that. Because they were trying to make it like how the characters were reacting to it, but I didn't know anything about these characters or care about these characters at all because they hadn't established that. So now I'm supposed to be watching this big event in their lives take place without anything to latch onto.
I mean, it's a good point. Latching on is the biggest thing that we were missing in this movie. There's nothing sort of engaging with a movie like JFK, another sort of historical courtroom drama based on an assassination. The courtroom aspect didn't come till the end. The movie asked a question that it delved into really sincerely about who was involved with this conspiracy and why and this and that. And this movie sort of forgot to ask any sort of really engaging questions other than, did she overhear? Did she know about this? I would love to see the history of this play out a little bit more. Outside the courtroom, like we maybe starting the movie with all the interaction between her and Booth and her son and all that, and sort of slowly reveal something interesting towards the end, but it just never did that.
Well, the courtroom scenes in this movie were the most watchable as far as I'm concerned, and I think a lot of times those in courtroom dramas, those are going to be the most interesting because they're the most revealing. They reveal information. But the problem even with these courtroom dramas is the way that this was set up is such a lose-lose situation for our protagonists that there wasn't really anything surprising happening. Anytime a witness turned, it was, oh, no kidding. You know, and it kind of got old after a while.
It got
frustrating.
Still, there were a lot of moments of murmuring in the courtroom.
Only so long you can watch your protagonist lose, for lack of a better term. Like, there's only so long you can watch him have everybody against him. And we talk about this with other movies where it's just like you're sick of watching everybody be against this guy. This guy can do nothing right. And while that's not really the idea behind this, there's just everybody's against him. He has no chance to win. So what's, you know, how can
scene after scene of characters covering the same ground, saying to McAvoy's character, Frederick Aiken, just saying, why are you doing this? This isn't good for your career.
His friends were the worst part of this movie.
After scene of the same thing. And that was one of the big problems with this movie was there was no real interesting character development.
I mean, you look at the scenes with Justin Long, Alexis Bledel, and the guy from The Departed that kills Leo in the elevator. I don't know what his name is.
Badge.
Those three, like you said, over and over again, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And it got to the point where it was so cliche that you have his girlfriend leaving him because she can't put up with the life anymore.
Why was she in this movie?
Why was she in this movie? Why was Justin Long with a mustache in this movie? Like, come on. They are clear. This looks like a reenactment. This looks like a high school play or a reenactment with the light coming in. Everything's overexposed because you don't want to see the actors' faces because you know that they can't portray the kind of emotion that these characters are supposed to have. Like, this is just so cheaply done sometimes.
Yeah, and exactly to the point, one of the biggest problems I had was that harsh light coming through. It looked like they had, like, a star filter on at times, which made it look cheesy. And even, like, almost like a soft focus at times as well that made it into, like, a soap opera-esque version of what this movie could have been.
I mean, I really think the reason they do that is because when they're doing these historical reenactments, it's not about the performances and stuff. So they probably tell the actors, stand here like this because this is how he stood. We don't need to see your face and your emotion, so just going to blow it out with the light coming in. That's what they did in this movie. When you're dealing with actors like McAvoy and Wilkinson and Klein, who are very capable of handling, you know, emotional material, but you know, they don't want to use that they have at their exposure, which is why I say, like, this is like Redford half-assing his way through it. He, you know, grabbed a few people to be in it and, like, yeah, you.
Well, that's the thing. This movie's been in the works since, like, 1993. Redford's wanting to do this. And he's a director that you would think this is material suited for him. I mean, as an actor, he was in maybe one of the best conspiracy movies of all time, the most intriguing conspiracy movie of all time, with All the President's Men. He's also been in several others, like 3 Days of the Condor and stuff. Like, he knows how these movies are supposed to work, beat by beat by beat, and intrigue an audience beat by beat by beat. But this movie forgot to add that element of mystery. It's called The Conspirator. Why are we not caring whether or not she was involved in this? Like, I didn't care. Like,
yeah, and then it tried to have, like, a – I think it – I mean, it definitely thought that it was allowing its audience to be attached to its character with its very, you know, Dead Man Walking type ending that it had there.
The ending was – I was the part where I finally was a little –
bit of a lack
little,
of emotion still there, though.
I was a little bit with them. All right, let's quickly just wrap this up because we've said a lot of bad things about this movie. Did anything work for you guys? Were there any scenes that worked for you guys? Any aspect of this film?
I mean, McAvoy was easily the best part of this movie. He made it worth watching and sitting through. I thought he was great.
I didn't think he was great. I thought he was okay.
And I've liked McAvoy. I've liked McAvoy. I haven't seen a lot of his movies. I've seen Last King of Scotland. I haven't seen, like, Atonement, which he's also, But, you know, this, for me, this movie makes me just want to see a whole lot more of him because I thought he was fantastic in this film.
Really? Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, McAvoy was good. I thought Wilkinson was good. I like when Stephen Root came in there and his little small guest role. I think that whole scene kind of worked really well.
The problem was that was, again, being the same thing going over and over again.
That
one was more towards the beginning, though.
That was my note.
That
was my note for the best scene of this movie was the Stephen Root scene. Yeah. Who was a great character actor that we don't really we talk about. I mean, he shows up in a lot of stuff. Sometimes he's maybe pigeonholed for the stapler in the Office, but
he's done a bajillion things,
Country for Old Men. He's always been a really good actor, and he was really good in this. And what I liked about that scene the most is it added the one layer of intrigue or sort of character development that this movie was missing when McAvoy started to have to throw her son under the bus or the cart or however you want to say it to save the mother. Okay, there's an interesting dynamic. She doesn't want this to happen. That's the scene where that was introduced, and I wish it had gone a little further, but then that gets easily resolved. She's like, oh, okay, I guess that has to. Eventually, it wasn't like that's when I started getting engaged, and Stephen Root's story and all that was.
Well, there was one point in the movie, and it goes to the son where McAvoy finally goes to the priest. He's like, can you give a message to him? His mother's going to die if he doesn't show up. I'm like, that was simple. Why didn't he just do that earlier? Granted, it doesn't work out the way he wanted to, but you know, he feel like he could have done that sooner, found out if he was going to get the son or not, and moved on.
So The Conspirator, it just didn't seem to work for us. I mean, it was missing that element of intrigue. It had a lot of stale dialogue. It seemed like we said earlier, it seemed like a historical, maybe even a historical middle school play that was put on to tell us about this time period without the most important element of an engaging story.
Lieutenant, do you recall an incident involving a PSC Curtis Bell who'd been found stealing liquor from the officers' club?
Yes, I do.
Did you report Private Bell to proper authorities?
I have two books at my bedside, Lieutenant. The Marine Corps Code of Conduct and the King James Bible. The only proper authorities I am aware of are my commanding officer, Colonel Nathan R. Jessup, and the Lord our God.
At your request, Lieutenant Kendrick, I can have the record reflect your lack of acknowledgement of this court as a proper authority.
Objection. Argumentative.
Sustained. Watch yourself, Counselor.
Did you report Private Bell to your superiors?
I remember thinking very highly of Private Bell, not wanting to see his record tarnished by a formal charge.
You prefer to be handled within the unit.
Yes, I most certainly did.
Lieutenant, do you know what a code red is?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so we left out kind of a portion of that film when we were discussing it, and that's courtroom dramas, because obviously we want to talk a little bit about that now because there's a lot. And for me, I kind of equate them to police procedurals and any episode of Law & Order because it's built-in exposition. You can get away with it because it's revealing the information that you need in a natural and realistic way. So if that's always with that being the case, you know, oftentimes courtroom dramas are enjoyable. I can't think of any off the top of my head, aside from maybe The Conspirator, that were just bad. But even the courtroom scenes in that were compelling enough to watch. So I want to know what separates, you know, the good from the great, really.
Well, or even the good from the bad. I mean, the thing about courtroom dramas is you're not going to go out and seek out the bad ones. So maybe we haven't seen as many. But for my money, the conspirator was among those bad ones. And what I think it lacked that the others had was an element of surprise. There was never those moments where there was moments where the courtroom was surprised, but there was never those moments where we as the audience got revealed the information that we were surprised about. In The Conspirator, all the information revealed was already revealed to us previous, for the most part. I mean, obviously a little here or there. For example, like when Evan Rachel Wood's character, Anna Surratt, has to testify. That was a big deal for the courtroom, but we already knew that was happening. That wasn't a surprise or engaging to us. And I think the good ones throw in these elements of all of a sudden the lawyer figuring something out and then presenting it, and then us as the audience being like, "Oh, okay, that's cool. That really works." And this movie didn't. The Conspirator didn't have those.
That's definitely part of it for me. But I think that the surprises are so structured into the story that they almost are seamless enough in good courtroom dramas that you don't look at them as surprises. What I really think separates the good from the bad. What I think separates the good from the great is the case with any movie, and it's your characters. Because you can have your structured story be compelling and interesting, but to really latch onto it, and we used that term earlier, you need to have interesting characters. You look at a movie like To Kill a Mockingbird and Atticus Finch, who is probably one of your most iconic characters of all time. To Kill a Mockingbird would not be the movie or the story that it is without that character. So I think if you take the time to create good characters, get good actors to portray them, that brings your procedural and your drama to the next level.
Right, but I think it is a combination of that, obviously, but it also is how the screenwriter and the director reveal information to your audience, how they slowly sort of peel away their plot, and how it's revealed to them is going to make any sort of procedural courtroom drama more interesting, because essentially they are people standing up and talking
and telling you exactly
and telling you what happened. So how do you reveal that information to make it more interesting? And you look at even a movie like A Few Good Men, which I haven't seen in a while, so it's kind of hard for me to. But you know, the famous moment there, "You Can't Handle the Truth," was. It was Tom Cruise's character pushing to reveal something that we didn't know if that information was going to be revealed. And when it was, boom, it hit us, just like it hit everyone in that courtroom.
If you look at, that's not even some of the Utah, like the reveals and the surprises, right? That's the big one, but there's a lot in that movie, and they're structured really well into it. Scenes like when Cruise realizes that Santiago hadn't packed, you don't realize that that's what he's realized until you get to the courtroom and he presents it, and that's kind of delaying that suspense
and delaying the audience's gratification too. And I think that's really important. All right, it's time to plug ourselves here at Get Your Film Fix, our favorite time. And first of all, we want to thank everyone who took the time to donate this week. We got a new site up. We have a new donate tab, and it goes such a long way to helping us do this and keep doing this, because we really enjoy it. And if you guys really enjoy it, then we can keep hopefully producing articles and podcasts and film students the mini-sode. So if you guys like any of that stuff, really encourage you to go over and donate, and we appreciate everyone who did this past week. So that being said, check out Film Students Get Your Film Fix website and keep listening to the podcast. Thanks everybody.
If I'm too old for this, then I got nothing. That enough truth to suit you?
This your speed bag?
But yours behind the counter. Wish I could say I wore it out.
Just hold it. Hold it. I'll show you a few things, and then we'll get you a trainer.
No. Sorry.
You're in a position to negotiate?
Yes, sir. Because I know if you train me right, I'm going to be a champ. I seen you looking at me.
Yeah, out of pity.
Don't you say that. Don't you say that if it ain't true. I want a trainer. I don't want charity, and I don't want favors.
All right, so with The Conspirator, we have Robert Redford directing the film. Robert Redford, of course, a former actor who has turned directors, and that kind of got us thinking about other actors turned directors who are out there working and have worked as well. It's interesting that The Conspirator didn't hit as many notes as we expected it to, just because of Robert Redford's pedigree as an actor and some of the other films he's been in. But kind of maybe moving away from that, like, what are some actors turned directors that you guys think are able to make that transition well and able to tell convincing stories and not just perform in them?
I mean, I think it's a twofold thing. I think some directors now, you know, I think when all is said and done, I will consider them directors before I consider them actors. And this may come as a surprise to, you know, some people, but like Clint Eastwood, I just look at him as a director.
Surprise? That's the first person I thought of.
I know, but the majority, I think, is going to consider him an actor.
Sure, and there's nothing wrong with that, but like we sort of, our film education came more through his director period. We weren't around during his more
the exact same thing could be said about Ron Howard, who, if you were to ask our parents, it would be Ron Howard the actor from Andy Griffith Show and Happy Days, but not, you know, the director of Oscar winning movies. So you even now look at a director like Ben Affleck. I hope that I someday consider him more a director than an actor, because I am not impressed with him as an actor. You know, I think if people are being honest with themselves, there are a few who do consider him a good actor. But two of his movies have been good movies. You know, one better than the other. But despite that, he's made a better turn as a director than he has as an actor.
Yeah, and there's some actor-directors that sort of every once in a while will step into a director. I don't know why I'm thinking of this, but like, I want to see that new movie with Clive Owen directed by David Schwimmer. What is it called?
Trust.
Yeah, I heard really good things about it. I don't know if we're going to ever consider David Schwimmer a serious actor or a serious director, but apparently that he really hit it out of the park with that movie, which hopefully we'll be able to see and review for this podcast. But there's been a bunch of actors around that same level that have just jumped back and forth, or you may not know.
Mel Gibson goes back and forth all the time.
Yeah, may not know.
Yeah, guys like Tony Goldwyn, who did
Conviction. Yeah,
and then I mean, obviously Tom McCarthy, who did Win-Win and Station Agent and things like that. Those are a lot of kind of lesser known actors. They're more character actors. You wouldn't really even think of as like big stars, but they've made the transition from to behind the camera as well.
So let's talk about these guys we've talked about so far: Affleck, Eastwood, Howard, Redford, and Gibson. And let's sort of compare them, and I think it's actually really an interesting point. Compare them to our bigger directors that are directors versus like Aronofsky and Tarantino and Nolan and those guys. Their storytelling techniques are very different. If you look at like the Affleck, Eastwood, Howard, Redford, and Gibson, they are just sort of storytellers. They aren't guys that you think of that are technically crazy or out there like an Aronofsky or a Nolan or even a Scorsese. Or an Anderson. They're not known for their camera movements. They're not known for their sort of look, but they are known, especially, and I've always said this about Eastwood, they are storytellers. They know what their story is, and they concentrate on that, and they want to concentrate on telling that pretty much as simply as possible. Gibson may be the exception there. You look at the Passion of the Christ, you look at
Apocalypto.
Those are more stylistic movies. But Eastwood, Affleck, Howard, and Redford, they're basic storytellers. They're not as interested in sort of the tracking shots or the Inception folding cities over each other or all that sort of stuff. And it's very interesting that these actors turned directors concentrate more on solely telling their story with the camera, while the Aronofskys, the Andersons, the Scorseses, obviously that's what they're doing, but they're also adding an element of style and, I guess, dare say the word, auteurs, you know.
It's interesting, and this kind of transitions a little bit to something I want to talk about, because if you were to really try to pick it apart, you would think, okay, coming from another profession in the film world, who would be the best storytellers as directors? Naturally, you would assume writers, or something like that, you know? And then who would be the best working with actors? You would think, you know, previous actors, which is what I want to bring up, because I was watching, this was a long time ago, watching special features on A Few Good Men. All the whole cast is talking about how great it was to work with Rob Reiner because he's acted before and he knows what actors like. So I did, you know, some boring research to come up with some boring stats about some performances.
That's what we need, more boring stuff.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping people would just tune in now. Yeah. And then,
This is one of those podcasts with boring stuff.
Well, it's interesting, whether it's boring or not, it's interesting. You look at some of the directors who were once actors and you look at some of the performances they got. So you have Ron Howard, he's gotten performance Oscars and Oscar noms all over the place for people. Russell Crowe, Jennifer Connelly, Franklin Jello was nominated for Frost Nixon. Then Robert Redford, everybody in Ordinary People got an Oscar. And Sidney Pollack has gotten Oscar noms for Meryl Streep, but she didn't need his help. Holly Hunter in The Firm. Rob Reiner has gotten Jack Nicholson got an Oscar nomination.
Again, didn't need his help.
Ben Affleck even managed to get a nomination for Jeremy Renner. Clint Eastwood, Sean Penn, and, you know, those are some of the ones we just mentioned. Well, everybody seems to be, and it's just lining up. Like, sometimes they don't need their help. You have to,
you could say the same thing about just directors. That
you can't, because Christopher Nolan, we always fault for that. Scorsese, we've always complimented for being an actor's director.
Yeah, Anderson's Aronofsky
is too. But
Aronofsky's got a lot.
Of course. This doesn't mean that other directors can't do it. But I think it does speak for these directors knowing how to work with actors.
Sure. I think we could definitely say it helps as an actor a certain comfort level. And you hear it over and over again working with a director that was previously an actor. I think that really helps. But I think the great directors also have that ability. Where they got it, I don't know. But I think a lot of them have that, you know, ability to be able to work with actors. And it is interesting you brought up Nolan, because we've said it before. We don't think he's the greatest actor's director there is. And
I mean, there's very few, you know, to borrow a phrase from baseball, five tool directors out there where they're technically good story, visually, acting. And there's a fifth one, too. The four tool directors.
Yeah. I knew you were like counting down. You're like, I gotta get five.
I was gonna do it in my head, but I knew I was gonna be able to think and listen and talk and all those things at once.
Coming up with stuff with numbers on the spot, have to fill out those numbers.
Not possible. So directors who have acted before, if nothing else, bring with them a unique perspective on the project that they're directing. But it still remains kind of interesting because, you know, Redford, like we mentioned, has been in movies, much like his film that he directed, The Conspirator. Yeah, in our opinion, he wasn't able to capitalize on some of the strengths of those other movies. So, you know, it's not always a winning situation, but it certainly offers them some insight and perspective that other directors may not have.
All right, it's top five time, and what we're going to do is our top five cinematic lawyers. And that reminds me, I just wrote an article about cinematic accountants on getyourfilmfix.com, so people want to make their way over to that. It is tax day, after all. All right, so top five lawyers. Any criteria, guys? Brantley, we'll start with you. Did you have any criteria? Did they have to be a lawyer, for example?
They had to be a lawyer.
Okay.
Other than that, I didn't really have anything crazy.
Did they have to be in the courtroom at any point?
Nope. They could have just been like a lawyer in his office.
Non-practicing lawyer.
You know? So, my criteria didn't really have anything. And, you know, I just went by, you know, characters I liked that I thought, you know.
That's good.
Characters I liked, you know.
All right.
So,
let's hear those characters you liked.
Number five for me is George Clooney playing Michael Clayton in the movie Michael Clayton.
See, now that might come up again, but that one was a tough one for me because I don't know if he was actually a lawyer.
Yeah,
he worked for a law firm. He was their investigator.
Like
he was like their fixer guy.
Yeah.
But I don't know if he actually was a lawyer, and I wasn't sure. But so that's why it may come up again, but now it may not because it was mentioned. So might have to do a little shifting around here. All right, my number five. A lot of people will go to this movie for one of the two lawyers in it. It is Philadelphia. I'm going with Joe Miller, played by Denzel Washington. since he is the one who prosecutes the case, Washington is the one that's taken out of his element in that movie, and he's the one that has to prosecute a case that he may not completely believe in. So that's why I went with Joe Miller, as played by Denzel Washington.
Some movie you have to see again. It's been a long time. All right, so I'm also kind of in the same book as Brantley here, my number five. I'm pretty sure he's a lawyer. I remember him arguing in the courtroom, but it may have been for his life. It's a movie we saw recently for Just Effing Watch It. It's Sir Thomas More, played by Paul Scofield, the great Paul Scofield.
That's your number five?
In it. My number five for A Man for All Seasons.
Only your number five.
What a performance. What a discovery that was for Just Effing Watch It.
All right. My number four. Since you already mentioned it, I'll keep it pretty clean and dirty, but that is Denzel Washington as Joe Miller.
How can you be clean and dirty?
I don't know.
I think it's quick and dirty is the phrase you're looking for.
Thank you.
Clean and dirty.
Quick and dirty. That's what I was looking for.
That's how Brantley likes it.
Yeah. All right. My number four is Tom Hayden in The Godfather, played by Robert Duvall. You never see him in a courtroom, doesn't do a whole lot of practicing of law, totally, but that character is such a good character.
Totally forgot about that.
Yeah,
isn't he also a lawyer in The Conversation? Isn't he?
Oh, I can't remember what his profession is in that.
He looks like one.
But he, obviously, I'm surprised you didn't think of him. It took me a while to remember him, but he's the lawyer for the Corleone family.
All right, my number four is Vincent Gambini, played by Joe Pesci in My Cousin Vinny. It's a great comedy. I mean, it really is. And, Joe Pesci was also in JFK.
Oh, tie-in.
We're going to tie that right in. And it's one of those few movies, I don't think, Joe Pesci kills anyone with a pen to the eye or throat. So that was nice. That was comforting.
All right. My number three is John Travolta as Jan Schlichtman in A Civil Action, which, of course, based in Massachusetts. Yeah. I think we're all familiar with that.
That's where we went to high school.
It's been a while since I've seen it. But, yeah, it was a decent film. Good lawyer. That was my criteria. So.
All right.
He's a real lawyer.
Yeah, really. Yeah, he still practices,
I believe.
My number three. Might not see it on either one of your lists. It is Fletcher Reed, played by Jim Carrey in Liar Liar.
Are you kidding me? Number three?
Why not? What is wrong with that character?
Oh, wow. Look at this. Look at this anger from Jeremy about Jim Carrey being on this list.
Come on. Whoa. Yeah, that's your defense?
Whoa. That's a little hoity-toity look down my nose until, at Lee's top five list
until
over
I here. Hear, until I hear a good defense of why Jim Carrey shouldn't be on my list.
A defense better than, come on.
Is that character ultimately that interesting? I mean,
the whole cliche of lawyers is that they lie all the time. And then you get put in a situation where you get Jim Carrey, who's going to be funny, and he can't lie.
Oh, it sounds ripe for parody.
It was, and it worked. I don't understand what your problem is with this movie.
Jeremy, the same could be said for Mr. Vincent Gambini.
No, come on.
It could. You have a New York lawyer put in the South.
Let's get this guy in a southern town as a lawyer.
I like your concept. I like what you're saying. That's hilarious, Brantley. I'm going to write a movie about that.
Oh, yeah.
All right. On a more serious note, my number three is Henry Drummond, played by Spencer Tracy in Inherent the Wind.
They're stealing all my gold picks. I thought I was going to have such an original list. Everybody's picking them out.
This is a movie I really haven't seen since high school, but
I think we still probably saw it in the same science class.
Probably. They edited out the part about
about evolution. That half.
he's just one of those down-to-earth actors. You're behind him from the beginning. There's no reason not to like him. You know, it's interesting. Back in the day, they could put a character like Spencer Tracy in a movie, and right away they don't need to have that scene where you see him becoming our protagonist. He's just our protagonist right from the beginning.
Yeah, he kind of has the Gregory Peck, got Jimmy Stewart syndrome.
All right, my number two is Matt Damon as Mr. Rudy Baylor in The Rainmaker.
Yeah, see, I haven't seen The Rainmaker.
You haven't seen The Rainmaker?
I've seen bits and pieces on TV.
It's a pretty good movie, man.
Yeah, I've wanted to see it for a long time.
Rourke.
I think that Matt Damon's going to do there. Well.
My number two is Spencer Tracy. That is Henry Drummond in Inherit the Wind.
Is Mr. Drummond saying that this expression of an honest emotion will in any way influence the court's impartial administration of the law.
I say that you cannot administer a wicked law impartially. You can only destroy. You can only punish. And I warn you that a wicked law like cholera destroys everyone it touches, its upholders as well as its defiers.
Colonel Drummond.
Can't you understand that if you take a law like evolution and you make it a crime to teach it in the public schools, tomorrow you can make it a crime to teach it in the private schools, and tomorrow you may make it a crime to read about it, and soon you may ban books and newspapers.
All right. Okay, so I'm being a little pretentious. A movie I can't remember, haven't seen since high school, but I'm still picking it out.
That's all right. My number two is kind of the same way, but I remember really, really liking Charles Laughton's performance as Sir Wilford in Witness for the Prosecution, a lesser-known sort of Billy Wilder film. I watched it when I was reading Conversations with – I think it was Conversations with Billy Wilder by Cameron Crowe. I wanted to say James Cameron, but I knew that wasn't right. So.
You wanted to talk about somebody successful, that's why.
By Cameron Crowe. And I was reading that and basically went through almost all of Wilder's movies while reading that book. But one of my biggest discoveries was Charles Laughton's performance here in Witness for the Prosecution.
All right. Well, down to number ones. My number one's probably a little oddball kind of pick for a lawyer, but I just love the character very much, and it's played to perfection.
Fletcher Reed in
Life. Yes, of course. it's played to perfection by Mr. Pete Postlethwaite, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, and that is as Mr. Kobayashi in The Usual Suspects.
I didn't even think of that. That kind of falls into the Tom Hayden thing where you never see him practicing law. I don't believe that he was real. Really a lawyer.
I don't even know if he was real.
Well, you see him.
You see him getting picking up. But
was he the lawyer? Who knows?
Was he still telling the story?
What do you mean? What was he?
He's like Kevin Spacey's shouting.
He
up
could have
to,
just been the cab driver or something that happened to get
just
in.
Just happened to be there for the rest of the story.
Yeah.
All right, my number one. I was so excited about my number one. I'm like, it's going to be great. Jeremy's going to be like, oh, good pick. But then he throws it out as his number five. It is Paul Scofield as Thomas More in A Man for All Seasons.
Sir Thomas More, you have been found guilty of high treason. The sentence of the court...
My lords, when I was practicing law, the manner was to ask the prisoner before pronouncing sentence if he had anything to say.
Have you anything to say?
Yes. Since the court has determined to condemn me, God knoweth how, I will now discharge my mind concerning the indictment and the king's title. The indictment is grounded in an act of Parliament which is directly repugnant to the law of God and his holy church, the supreme government of which no temporal person may by any law presume to take upon it.
I mean, you know, I don't know how that was only your number five. That's such a... I mean, I had to look up to be sure that he was a lawyer. I was pretty sure that he was.
100%.
I was pretty sure that he was, and it turned out that he was. So, you know, talk about using your knowledge of the law to, you know...
ultimately fail.
Yeah.
All right, my number one is the most obvious pick, and I sort of hedged my bets saying that they won't do it because it's the obvious pick. And that's why my streak for cash is at 8. I'm at 8 wins for the ESPN streak for cash.
I'm at 1 because I keep going back and forth.
It's because
how many do you have to get for streak for the cash?
It's the most in the month. So and right now I think it's like at 20.
It's at 20.
Oh, so you're like 12 behind.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got to be 12 anytime. Behind at some point. You got to be, you know.
Yeah.
So anyhow,
I'm only 19 behind.
Number one. The point is, Atticus Finch, played by Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird, it's going to help me win some cash through ESPN.
I love how Jerry looks down on the liar pick, but he has the two most obvious lawyers ever Pesci and Atticus.
But here's the thing, Finch. You know, he looks down on me for, you know, kind of having a fun pick of sorts. I mean, how our listeners would look down on us if we didn't have Atticus Finch in our top five lawyers.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
shame on us if we all avoided
the
Atticus
memorial.
Finch memorial list, which we didn't preface.
No, we didn't. And the fact that you guys left it off the list.
I'm very glad intentionally. I assumed it would show up.
Yeah. Just yeah, an obvious pick. Twice my number one. My number one obvious pick of all time. If we do a top five obvious picks, I'm going to get it. And Brantley's going to be the other four.
All right, so that wraps up our top five. Wraps up Jeremy's ridiculously obvious top five, in which he had fun with picks like great picks with iconic film characters like Fletcher Reed.
Yeah.
I mean, even I think that sounds funny coming out of my mouth.
All right, so just send who had the better picks? Send it to feedback@getyourfilmfix.com.
I actually, I would love if we could get something like that going. If like
feedback going, that would be awesome.
No, not just feedback. People vote on the winner for the top five each week.
All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, check out the site, getyourfilmfix.com. You know, check out the articles, film students, got the donate button, you know, the email for feedback, all that stuff. Also, check out Exterior Films and their podcast. Check out their film, The Gray Area. If you can go to their website, thegrayarea.com. And thanks for listening, everybody.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.
Just intriguing. Go ahead.
For what?
We're going to have to go back to...
Bank robbery movies, you got Heat, you know. That's
one. Oh, man. I mean, maybe the Sherlock and Holmes.
One. Yeah, Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes. What Sherlock were they? Top five.
Sherlock.
Top five mystery
Sherlock
solving
duos. Sherlock and mystery. Holmes. I did hear you say Sherlock and Holmes. Both of them.
I don't speak very well.
We know.